equally worked out a whole thing. He's got a whole bunch of formulas here and all how he works out, you know, to get the proper, you know, how to figure out the number of turns, of course, and to figure out, you know, how to mark it off so you can make it nice equal down, in other words, nice equal coil, linear coil down the whole line stick over.
Okay, I'm beginning to believe. So I think you're saying we've had a fair amount of mail on the helically wound antenna, which means you're building physically a nearly infinitesimal antenna as far as the good books are concerned. And so when you shrink down the physical length of a half-wave-like antenna, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to have less capture area, you're going to have less gain, and that's not true. Build it out of lossless materials, put it into a chunk of space where it's not seeing a whole lot of earth-ground loading, so to speak. In other words, enough radials if it's a quarter-wave type or high enough above the ground or half-wave type. You still get, with low-loss materials, near 100% radiation efficiency. And the gain that you lose when you go from a full half-wave length of a dipole down to physically shrinking it as small as you like and you can still resonate it, you only lose 4/10 of a dB of gain. That's amazing. An infinitesimal dipole, instead of having 2.14, has still got 1.76 dB of gain over isotropic. Not an easy concept for some people to accept, but there's been enough measurements to say that it's really true. Krauss, on his pivotal book on the subject of antennas, has a whole chapter devoted to the infinitesimal dipole. It's very narrow band, high in Q, hard to impedance match. But once you impedance match it, it's going to work like a charm. Over to you, Mel, KQRIW.
That's what I wanted to clarify, because I know people ask me, they said, did you say one wavelength of wire? In other words, from end to end, a half wave on each side. And that's what I wanted to clarify. And yes, the impedance will be somewhere around maybe 15 ohms or so, 12, 15 ohms, somewhere in that neighborhood, if I'm not mistaken, when I measured it. And 4-to-1, simple 4-to-1 valum, or valum, however you want to pronounce it, will fix that up. You can find it simple enough, it's simple winding, you know, you to make a valum like that up. You can wind one yourself very simply, just need a toroid and a couple of pieces of wire. And in fact, I think a lot of the guys will, and he even specified that he was using that plastic speaker wire, you know, they sell at the Radio Shack that looks like clear plastic. You can see the copper wire inside of it. I think that's what Jerry was using many times for winding them thick over.
It was last week that you gave us a formula where T for tango equals square root of S squared minus L squared all over C squared. And tell us once again, Mel, what T, S, L, and C, the four variables. Tell us once again on that formula you gave us last week what they all stand for. I believe the C stands for the length of one turn. The L, I think, is the total length of the PVC pipe. And I'm not perfectly sure now what the T and the S stands for. Back to you, Mel.
Well, this came from way back. I found it. I found some ideas how to do this in a an old calculus book. I dug out some of the old calculus books. I said, I saw something like this somewhere, some reference, and I went crazy. And I gave it over to a friend of mine that I think he did publish it some years ago. One of the magazines, this formula, I said, here, do whatever you like with it. I'll tell you how you do it if you want to wind a coil, you know, on a piece of length of pipe, how to come up with, you know, how to get to how many turns you need. Now, let me remember how I taught. Yeah, T equals the square root of S squared, that's the length of the wire, minus the L, the length of the space wind, you know, in other words, the form that you're going to use, how long the pipe is, the PVC pipe, that's what L stands for. And C is the length of one term. In other words, you take a piece of the wire, you put it around the piece of PVC, and you see how much, and then you take it off and you measure how long, how much wire, this piece of wire you need to, you know, go around the pipe one time. In other words, you convert all this to inches. So, if, for instance, let me think, like for a 20-meter section, let's talk, let me let it drop. I'll give you an exact, for instance. Say for 20-meter section, we're going to use a piece of irrigation pipe. And if we were going to wind, say, you know, half of it, if the pipe, let's say, is 8 feet long, that would be 96 inches. And if, let's see, the length of the wire we're using, I don't know, what the heck, length of wire, about 8 feet or something, whatever it is, you convert that to inches. So, and then you would divide it by, if let's say it takes 4 inches to go around the pipe, so that would be 4 inches. So you put this all into the formula, I don't know what I'm saying, really. And take the square root of it, and that'll tell you the how many turns you'll need to go around this length of pipe, Dick, over.
Okay, so T for turns equals square root of S squared, where S is length of wire, minus L squared, where L is length of the PVC pipe, all divided by C squared, where C is the length of one turn, and all of that jazz is all under the square root sign. Okay, we know what the terms stand for, and I think you're saying that if you plug in typical dimensions of the kind of antenna we're talking about, we'll end up with approximately one wavelength of wire for a half-wave electronic dipole. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Right, and if you want to know the spacing, in other words, you want to get the wire nice and even down the pipe, what you do is you take the number of turns that you came up with, the T, and divide by that length of the piece of wire. So that'll give you the... wait a minute. I mean, how did I... Let me get this straight in my mind again. The... if you want to know the how much spacing between each turn, you divide the length of the pipe by the number of turns. So if the pipe, in other words, let's say the pipe is 10 feet long, would be 120 inches. And if you had 100 turns, it came out to 100 turns, you would divide that 120 by 100 and come out with a figure that would give you the spacing on the the turns along the pipe stick, so you can make it nice and even. That's what I'm trying to bring out, over.
Yeah, in your example of a 120-foot-long, 120-inch-long PVC pipe with 100 turns of wire, it'd be 1.2 inches per turn. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, getting another one of these electronic mails here, emails from my daughter here. All right. Okay, Dad. Thank you for mentioning my name on the air. And good night to you and Dick. All right, very good. Basically, in other words, this gives you, so you make a nice even, you know, coil across the whole thing. And then you could give it a coat of, you know, some of that varnish. That'll fix the coil permanently if it's going to sit out on the windowsill, Dick, over.
Understand. What kind of a radio did you supply to Julie so she can listen to the TechNet? And what are her call letters?
I haven't got any call letters. I got a ham light. Learned the CW and everything, and really loved all the stuff and all the, you know, became a teenager, had other ideas. I got her a Radio Shack Realistic Pro 20, I think 28 scanner, so that she can listen to, I should say, all the jazz. And she gets a kick out of listening, you know, to different, it covers a lot of, you know, VHF, UHF communication, that scanner. It really has a lot of nice features on it. So she listens to the different, she says she's always listening to police, the fire department, whatever, but make sure that she listens to us Sunday night, over.
Understand. Okay. What's the next question you think we should be answering from your mailbag?
Hey, I'm trying to keep them, you know, that people won't lose interest. Get a lot of, like you said, people losing interest. But, all right, this part of the net will really stay with ham radio as much as possible. I have purchased a Yagi in a bag. Oh, yeah, I saw this advertised. They have these different Yagi antennas that you can buy for, I think, from 10, no, from 6, no, 2 meters? Yeah, 2 meters, 6 meters, 10, 12, 15, 18, yeah, 17 meters, 20 meters. They got this Yagi in a bag they've been advertising. And the thing about it is, which I didn't realize, instead of a reflector, it's a two-element Yagi. Instead of a reflector, they give you a director, a driven element and a director. Can you give us a reason for that, over?
Okay, run it by one more time. If it's only a two-element Yagi, they give us a reflector instead of a director, or they give us a director instead of a reflector. Which one did you just say, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, they give you the driven element, but instead of a reflector for it on the boom, if the, you know, I can say it's all folds up into a bag, they give you, instead of a reflecting element, they give you just a directing element on this two-element Yagi. A director and a driven element, over.
Okay, I've got a good guess on that one. If you're only adding one parasitic element, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to make it a reflector. You think if you cancel the signal flowing in the back direction and reflect all that energy going forward, you're doing the most desirable thing. By comparison, everyone thinks the director just sucks a little bit of the energy out of the driven element and directs it forward. If you really study one single parasitic element and which one gives you the most amount of gain increase in the forward direction, I think a director gives you more than a reflector if you're only adding one parasitic element. I'm pretty sure that's true, and if we confirm it, it'll give us a pretty good clue as to why a two-element Yagi on many designs includes only a director, not a reflector. I think you get more bang for your money out of the director if you're not restricted in spacing. If you've got to force that parasitic element to be super close, now I'm not so sure. But if they give you proper spacing, I think you get more bang for your dollar out of a director than a reflector. Back to you, Mel, KQLAW.
I'm just thinking about this. If we go ahead and we're to build a Yagi, and we want it very compact, like you say, portable, this thing, they call it a Yagi in a bag, and we were sticking to a theory that if we made the boom, what can we squeeze it down to? 0.1 wavelength of boom, would that be within reason, Dick? If you squeeze it down to 0.1 wavelength of boom, would we be better off with a director than a reflector? Would that make any sense, over?
I think the answer is yes. I think you get a little bit more gain out of a single director than a single reflector when you can't use more than a tenth of a wavelength of boom. I think that's true, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, there would be the answer, because with a for like 20 meters or so of Yagi in a bag, 0.1 wavelength of boom would be, you know, only about, what, maybe around 6 feet or so, six and a half feet. that would be manageable, because I know what that thing looks like. You know, it sits up on a tripod. And it's basically for, you know, take it down to the beach, go out there in the park or whatever. And you want something a little bit more than maybe just a basic dipole, something with a little bit. What can you really expect? I guess it'll be a little more directive, more of the front, some front to back. But I don't know. I guess I guess it will work somewhat. But it sounds like that would be reasonable to expect that a short boom would be better off to use maybe, I could say, a director than a reflector. I think that that's the thinking deck, over.
Yep, that, I guess that's it, Bill. What else do I know about very simple, small number of element Yagis? I've done a lot of work with three element Yagis at UHF frequencies. I've done very little work with two element Yagis, so I'm not super sure about all this. I've got a lot of empirical evidence, a whole lot of hands-on experiments that were done with three element Yagis. And at UHF frequencies, you can make a very effective antenna range. It's only a couple of feet long from front to back of the antenna range, putting enough absorbing material, anechoic material, around the room to get rid of all the reflections in the room is a bit of a pain. But once you do that, you can get some very good data out of that. And one of the things that I discovered is that the super fat elements, driven element and director and reflector, all being super fat, I'm talking about approaching a tenth of a wavelength in thickness of element. It looks crazy, but you pick up some fantastic benefits when you do it. It's a whole area that has not been properly investigated, and one of the reasons it hasn't been investigated is it's so extremely difficult to model it. The currently available modeling programs, for the most part, cannot handle that situation. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QAQ with a question.
Go ahead, Glenn.
In the case of a two-element Yagi, and you have, you know, one driven element by itself, it's basically a dipole, but when you add the reflector, is it really giving you gain, or is it more just directivity? In other words, if you were to look at the, I guess, the gain off of the front end of the dipole, in other words, and you add the reflector in back of it, is it really increasing the gain much, if anything, in that direction, or is it really just giving you directivity by kind of preventing the signal from squirting out the back, so to speak? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a series of questions, Glenn, so that you can answer the question yourself. I'm going to give you a little bit of information on each step, and I'm going to ask you a question. First of all, if you and I are building antennas of the kind you're describing, and if we're smart, we're going to use low-loss materials. We're not going to make things out of carbon rods. We're going to use nice, conductive copper pipes and silver-plated pipes and copper wires and so on. So we're using low-loss materials for the impedance matching, the balance, the transmission line, and the antenna. Once you and I use low-loss materials, we're going to get very close to 100% radiation efficiency. I put 100 watts into the antenna, and 99 watts is going to be radiated into space. That's a given. Once you look at nothing but the class of low-loss material antennas, and now you start talking about modifying the antenna pattern, where it's not the ordinary donut pattern you get from a dipole, but now you're favoring some direction and unfavoring some other direction of that normal donut pattern. You're making the donut pattern, let's say the donut is laying flat on the table, and you're making the donut fatter toward the north and skinnier toward the south. That's the way we're modifying the donut pattern. Within the laws of conservation of energy, when I make that modified pattern, I've got a brand new directivity pattern. Can you envision any way of changing directivity that does not change the gain decibel for decibel? Back to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Well, you see, see, this is the point where I just don't know, and that's why I'm going to the Yagi expert, because the only other possibility I could think of would be normally off of a dipole, broadside you have gain, and to the tips of the dipole is a somewhat of a null. Now, if you put the reflector in the back, does it broaden up the null area and give you kind of about the same out the front, or is it really increasing out the front? That's really my question, because I don't know. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, if we only talk about the class of Yagis, where all the elements are straight-out dipole-like structures, and they're all laying parallel to each other along a boom. If we talk about that class of Yagis, where we're not curving the elements up, down, left, right, front, back, or whatever, they're all straight elements. In that class of Yagis, since every dipole has a null off the tips, every Yagi of that type, properly fed, has a null off the tips. There is no mechanism of radiating collinear to any of the dipole-driven element or parasitic element. None of the parasitic elements or the driven element have any capability of radiating in the collinear direction. So all of these antennas that you and I are now talking about will have a null in that direction. That's a given, no change there. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I kind of see what you're saying. I guess the part that always confuses me with this one is that, then what is it that actually determines the direction? In other words, one is a reflector, because it's a little bit longer in phase, I guess, and the directors are always a little bit shorter and spaced out in front. So it just, is it really just the spacing that determines the direction I'm screwing up my words here. Let's see. If the driven element is a certain wavelength tuned, and then you have an impedance matched, and the element, whether it's in other words, if it's a two-element device, what determines what the direction of the antenna? In other words, okay, if it's a reflector, it's going to be a little bit longer. And if it's a director, it's going to be somewhat shorter than the driven element. So is that really the only thing that's affecting the direction? Is the length of the element on the other side? Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I see where you're going, and that's a difficult way to go, and let me modify the problem. Let's assume that instead of building an antenna with a single driven element, I build an antenna with two driven elements. It's a two-dipole array, and the two dipoles are broadside to each other along the boom. So I've got a dipole-driven element. I've got what looks like a director, but it happens to be another dipole, and it's got a feed line going to it. So I got two driven elements. And just for my first experiment, I'm going to make them a quarter wavelength apart. Let me think about that one. Yeah, I think quarter wavelength apart is right. Yes. I'm going to make them a quarter wavelength apart. You could call it a phased array antenna. And I now want to fire in an end fire, what they call end fire. I want to fire in the direction along the boom. I got these two dipoles on the boom. They're a quarter wavelength apart. And every end fire antenna, every interferometer, phased array, it's a phased array, fires in the direction of the delay. Okay? So the forward element, let's assume that I've got these two elements going east-west, I've got this boom parallel to the ground, but it's up at a high altitude, and the most northern dipole, I feed it with a quarter wavelength of extra feed line, so I'm feeding it late. It's a quarter wave mechanically spaced, and electronically, I'm feeding it a quarter wave late. Now let's study what happens to the signal coming out of the most southern dipole. The most southern dipole gets the signal first, and it radiates it both north and south. By the time the peak of the wave comes out of the southern dipole, propagates north, and hits the northern dipole got its signal delayed, but now those two signals are in phase, and they support each other. They add. The voltages add. So, for the signal going to the north, the signal coming out of the lower dipole and the upper dipole, for the signal propagating toward the north, they add together in phase perfectly. I get twice as much signal going to the north in my simplistic example. For the signal going...
Repeater, time out.
For the signal going to...
CJK.
Absolutely right. Doug just telling us that's the way the WHJK Lazy H antenna works. He may have half-wave spacing, but I'm using quarter-wave in my example here. When I now study what happens for a signal that starts off from the northern dipole, he already was a quarter-wave late. When he gets to the southern dipole, spatially he arrives with another quarter-wave of delay, and because the southern dipole was fed a quarter-wave ahead, that now the total difference between the two is a half-wave. They cancel. So for the signal leaving the northern dipole going to the south, it hits the southern dipole 180 degrees out of phase. For the signal starting off at the southern dipole going to the north, they hit each other in phase. So, first of all, can you see how this two-element interferometer will make a beautiful supporting signal to the north and essentially cancel the signal to the south? Does that make some sense to you so far, Glenn? KC2QIQ, KQLIW?
Yes, it does, Dick, and because I've studied a lot also on, like four-square antennas and very similar kind of properties. Now, the delay is determining the direction, and you're getting the null and because of the phase canceling, and then you're getting the enforcement in the front. But is that really what's happening in the Yagi? In other words, when you only have one driven element, do you have the real phase cancellation on the reflector and the and on the director you're getting the enhancement? Is it really working the same way? Because that's really the confusing part to me, at least, about the Yagi.
Okay. Let's just talk now about a driven element to the south and a parasitic director to the north. Instead of feeding that director to the north as a second driven element, a two-element phased array, I'm now going to make it a real parasitic element. Already I've got a delay because of the spacing, but some signal is going to be coupled into it. However, rarely on a Yagi do you make the spacing a quarter wave. That's a little bit on the wide side. I'll make it a little bit less than quarter wave, but I'll create an additional delay by adjusting the length of that element. Electronically, I am shifting the phase of the signal that gets absorbed and re-radiated by that director, that parasitic element. When I set the length just right and the spacing just right, you can't tell the difference between whether that director is fed with a second feed line or it's fed parasitically. If I do a good job, it all comes out the same. I get close to the same amount of signal. I'll admit that in the parasitic array, the signal on that forward director is going to be a little bit weaker. But except for that slight weakness, it really is a two-element array, and I've got complete freedom to adjust the phase by using spacing and length of the parasitic element. So a two-element Yagi with a director is damn close to being a two-element phased array with two driven dipoles. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Which is kind of interesting because the initial question was, I think, if I heard it correctly, was that if you had, which would be, you know, a shorter boom, would be the two directors versus the director and a reflector. And from what you've just shown is that here you could have, because of the phase delay, you can have the director closer to the driven element and a little bit shorter on a shorter boom and probably get an equivalent kind of gain as you would with the just having a driven and a reflector, which would probably have to be a little bit longer off the back, I would think. Back to you on that, K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
The amount of excitation that gets from the driven element to a director, or the amount of excitation that gets from a driven element to the reflector, is very similar. In the case of the director, I want it to lead in phase. I want it to lag in phase. And therefore, I make that element act capacitive. Any dipole-like structure that is built too short develops a strong capacitive reactance. A capacitive reactor is a phase-shifting device, and it shifts in the direction of delay. So I've got two variables in my hand, spacing and length. And when I get them just right, I'm making a slow wave structure to the forward director. I'm creating that delay. That two-element parameter will radiate to the north a hell of a lot better than to the south. I've got the complete freedom of doing the same thing with the reflector. I can make the reflector longer, and it becomes inductive. And an inductive device starts leading in phase, so I can adjust the phase. There's a little bit more complication going on here now as to how big a signal I can make and how much phase delay I can get in the case of the reflector directing, the reflector method as opposed to the director method. For a couple of reasons that's a little bit beyond what I can easily explain right now, you get a little bit more bang for that process out of a director than you do out of a reflector. But with the simplistic examples I've used up till now, the length of the boom with a single director or the length of the boom with a single reflector would be rather similar, with the simplistic example. But there's another level of what goes on here, which we haven't gotten into. But I think you can see now that when you change the pattern by making this two-element interferometer, where you're supporting the signal going to the north and nulling the signal going to the south. That's step number one. Let me drop. Step number two, you're using low-loss material, so you put 100 watts into it, 99 watts is being radiated. So you've got a nearly 100% efficient antenna. All of the signal's going to be radiated. So once all the signal is radiated, and once you have the ability to adjust the pattern, reinforcing to the north and nulling to the south, by whichever means you use, a director, a reflector, or the combo. From that point of view, I'm now going to ask you a tough question, Glenn. In your mind, tell me the difference between directivity and gain. Let's call it directive pattern and gain pattern. What's the difference if the antennas that we're discussing have 100% efficiency? KC2, QI2, K2LIW.
Well, it would just be the phase and the direction of delay, quite simply spoken. So from what you're saying, that it should be a wash in that simplistic explanation. But back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
2RSO with the balloon analogy? Yeah, we're going to give you the balloon analogy in a minute there, Frank. When the average guy is asked to make a directivity pattern, he puts the antenna on an antenna test facility. He sweeps it 360 degrees in azimuth, and that's the pattern he wants to measure. He records all the data. When he plots the data, he normalizes it. He takes the peak of the response, and he's going to draw a polar graph, and he sets the peak of the response right at the outside perimeter of the polar graph. He normalizes it. And you and I called it a directive pattern. If the guy is asked to do a gain pattern, it is the exact same pattern on the polar graph, but instead of the outer circle being called 0 dB, and the next circle inside being minus 5, and the next one minus 10, and the minus 15, he makes the outer circle the real gain number. The antenna's got 4 dB of gain. The outer circle is called plus 4 dB, and you readjust all the circles accordingly. A gain pattern and a directive pattern are the exact same pattern if you use the same units. You can plot volts, you can plot watts, you can plot decibels. In my example, I was plotting decibels. As long as you keep the units of plot the same, the gain pattern and the directive pattern are identical. There's another way of wording this. Some people will say the pattern is called the directive pattern, and gain is the directive pattern where you subtract the losses. If there's 1 dB of feed line loss wrapped inside of my antenna, and I can't take it out of there for some crazy reason, the directive pattern and the gain pattern would be identical, except there'll be 1 dB of difference. If you're making an antenna out of lossless materials, there is no difference between directivity pattern and gain pattern. The way it's typically taught, the way it's typically described in the books, can lead you to believe that something else magic is going on. When you look at the formula for measuring directivity, and you look at the formula for measuring gain, and you plug in 0 dB for the loss element of that formula, you'll find repeater.
Time out.
you'll find out it's the exact same formula for loss or for gain or directivity. The only way an antenna can ever have gain is not an amplifier. An amplifier, you put 15 volts and an ampere into it, you give it the ability to make a bigger signal coming out than you put in. An antenna has got no B-plus terminal to it. Gain of an antenna is really lack of loss in some other direction. It's like a flashlight with a parabolic reflector. You're taking some of the signal that would have gone into some direction and refocusing it in some other direction, continuously obeying the laws of conservation of energy. So you're focusing action. Most people will call it directivity. Just so happens, the focusing action just happens to be gain. Within lossless antennas, there ain't any difference. Let me first pass it back to Glenn to see if that made some sense before we go over to Frank. KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, it does so far, Dick. You know, most of this I kind of do realize, but I'm always, I'd rather hear it from you first. You know, because I kind of figure it out a little bit, but there again, it's you make it sound a little bit clearer, and it kind of like reinforces some of my knowledge on this. The only other question I would have is just, you know, the next step you were talking about, you're almost alluding to the next problem is because of the loss in the equation. Apparently there's, you're almost alluding to that there's less loss when you're going in the forward direction as opposed to the reflecting direction. Maybe if you want to, maybe you can explain a little bit more about that maybe next week or whenever you want to. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm going to hold on, Frank, a little bit longer. You're on something extremely important here. And the word loss has got about four different meanings. In Glenn's mind right now, describe the word L-O-S-S. What does that mean to you right now, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, when I speak about loss in antennas, I'm typically talking about reduction in gain because there's some kind of either a resistance or something that's happening, and there's a reduction in gain in the forward direction. So whatever the method is of loss in forward gain or whatever it is would be what I would consider a loss. Back to you, Dick.
I think I'm very close to agreeing with you. My definition of antenna loss is I squared R loss, heating loss. If I've got five candidate antennas that I want to use and I want to have high efficiency, what I really do, and I'm not kidding, I put 1 watt into the antenna continuously and I look at it with a thermal imaging camera. What got hot? If nothing got hot, by definition, the antenna is 100% efficient. So if all of my antennas have no real I squared R loss mechanism. See, once you take energy and convert it into heat, usually it's lost forever. Yeah, there are Peltier devices which can convert a thermal difference back into voltage, but except for that, normally a loss mechanism is a heating mechanism. You take your valuable RF energy that you spend big dollars to develop it in your transmitter, and if your feed line is lossless, it runs ice cold. If your antenna is lossless, it runs ice cold. That feed line might have 3 dB of loss per 100 feet. You've got 100 feet of it. That means that feed line got hot. That is the only way it can waste 3 dB of power, thermally. If I'm using low-loss materials where everything runs ice cold, there can't be any difference in loss whether I'm using a director or a reflector with what we've discussed so far. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely. But it only sounds like, though, if you're getting 3 dB of loss in your feed line for every 100 feet, boy, I got to turn you on to some new coax. Back over to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If I was using 100 feet of transmission line at 10 gigahertz, if I could get the loss as low as 3 dB, I will pay you a lot of money. The best thing you and I can use on 10 gigahertz with reasonable sizes is WR90 waveguide at 9/10 of an inch wide, 0.45 inch high, silver plated, dry nitrogen filled, mil spec, Andrew produced, as the best stuff you can buy, 4.5 dB per 100 feet, and you're happy to get it. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely. I was just joking, Dick. laughing because most of everybody on here is working on 2 meters and 440. Probably never see much more above that. Let us see that. But certainly when I was working at MPD, every time we would take test kits for, you know, the network analyzers, and you had to normalize them every time you went up, you know, stepped up your sweep on frequency going into the gigahertz. So every time we were in the MIC group and you're using working around 10 up to 22 gig and a little bit above that, every time you switch that range, you have to recalibrate all the test kits because the loss, even just in a, you know, a short, like, foot and a half length of test cable was, you know, like quarter of a dB. Back over to you, Dick.
Yeah. It turns out that all connectors essentially have no loss because there's not enough length there for something to get hot. Transmission lines have loss because you got real dielectric materials with a loss tangent and you got some number of feet of the stuff. Or at microwave frequency, some numbers of inches or centimeters of the stuff. Okay, Frank wants to tell us about a balloon. He's also going to relate it to a beanbag. You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. K2RIW in the group. Here is N2RSO. And the analogy is a common one that I learned many years ago. When asked to describe what antenna gain is, someone, and I don't recall who the person was, gave the following 20-word statement. Creating antenna gain is like squeezing a balloon. You can increase it in some direction at the expense of others. I think that just about says it all in the most simplistic way as possible. Back to that in 2 hours, so.
Yeah, if any normal balloon used at sea level, it is very difficult to change the volume of the air in the balloon. You just don't have enough resources to squeeze that hard, so to speak. So as you push in on the balloon in some direction, it's going to bulge out in some other direction, and the total volume of air inside the balloon is going to stay the same. And maybe it becomes a little bit more clear if you do it with a beanbag. But the balloon analogy that Frank is using not only does it show you that gain of an antenna is really lack of loss in your desired direction, and a hell of a lot more loss in some other direction, conservation of energy. But Frank's balloon analogy brings out the fact that every antenna is a three-dimensional object. We may take a slice through the middle of it and plot the E-plane pattern and the H-plane pattern, and there's a hell of a lot of times when we think that's all there is. You got to look at the whole thing three-dimensionally as an object of rotation in many cases. And so it's the total energy in all of those directions. It has to be added up, and it's got to add up to damn close to 100%, if you know what I mean, if you've done an accurate set of measurements. If I'm putting 100 watts into the antenna, and if it's lossless and runs ice cold, and I add up all of the energy across every single square degree on the surface of a sphere where my measurement is done on the sphere around the antenna, and that sphere contains 41,253 square degrees. If I take my globe and divide it up into one degrees of latitude and 1 degree of longitude, I get all these little square degrees. Near the poles, it gets complicated because they're not quite square anymore. They're triangles. But I add it all up accurately. 41,000 square degrees. Every antenna pattern has got 41,000 square degrees of energy being squirted somewhere. And if you really want to know the antenna gain and pattern and directivity and all this jazz, you got to add them all up. It's not just the E-plane or the H-plane. There are certain kinds of antennas that have a real clean-looking E-plane, maybe a pretty clean-looking H-plane, but the 45-degree planes have got some great big ugly lobes. There are some microwave antennas that'll do that. They could be robbing your gain, and with your normal plot, you don't see it until you start plotting three-dimensionally with some of these fancy plotting programs like HFSS, among others. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all this?
Repeater, timeout.
Any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW.
This is WA2SAY, and I would like to talk to you about a little bit of stuff you mentioned before.
Okay, let's discuss what you mentioned before. But before we do, let's make sure that no one else is dissatisfied if we drop this subject at this time. Is everybody happy if we go away from this subject right now? And if not, speak now or forever hold your peace tonight.
Yeah, K2KY, some final words.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I'm also thinking about this you know, situation. I would say that if you were selling something like this Yagi in a bag, I could also see one thing more that you decide, you know, to short a boom. I could say also that by using a director rather than a reflector, that the director will be approximately 5% shorter than the driven element. Would that be a rule of thumb, 5% shorter by using the director stick? Over.
In that approximate number, you're right. Therefore, the total length of the elements that you've got to stuff into the bag gets smaller, and it's a more compact antenna. Is that where you're going, Mel?
Yeah, I would say so, because, the constraint of how you're going to pack it is going to be, which is the longest element. So if you can't do very much, I guess, about maybe shortening maybe the director much more. The driven element much more, so you'd like to keep your next, whatever other element, within that constraint stick, over.
So there's a double benefit of making a two-element Yagi with a director as a parasitic element instead of a reflector. It's shorter, lighter, faster, more streamlined, cheaper, better, and a tiny bit more gain than using a reflector for a couple of complicated reasons we haven't gotten into here yet tonight. Okay, looks like we're going to develop a little bit of time to Yagis on many of these technets. I think Doug wants to discuss something else. Doug's audio is a little bit low, so I'll repeat his question after he says it. WA2SAY, the microwave voice of Rocky Point, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I hope my audio is not that low, but anyway, I wanted to get back to your discussion of fat elements. You talked about Yagi. Fat elements, and I'm wondering whether you're talking about printed circuit Yagis, wide elements, or perhaps physical Yagis with elements like front portion or something. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Doug wants to know, are the fat elements printed circuit flat elements that are fat, or are the Bronkhorst round elements? And the answer is yes to both. If you do a scan of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and you do a scan on my name as an inventor, you'll find out that I've got a patent. I didn't file the patent. It was done through the company I was doing some consulting for. But the first name as an inventor on the patent is my name. And you'll see a Yagi done in a printed circuit manner, with extremely wide elements. And there's a huge set of benefits in certain applications you get out of doing that. It's opposite of common sense. We sort of fell into that one with a bunch of laboratory experiments. And you almost cannot model that antenna of that patent. That's why no one discovered that characteristic before. What's unique about that Yagi with extremely wide elements is that, number one, it's got 6.1 dB over isotropic of gain for a compacted Yagi with three elements. In other words, it doesn't have the full boom length that was required, but yet it's still got 6 dB over ISO of forward gain. But the real magic of that antenna is that it has a standing wave ratio that does not exceed 1.06 to 1 across a 3% bandwidth. The whole band from 902 to 928 that you used to do a lot of commercial work in, Doug, and you used to be happy with an antenna with a 2-to-1 Viswar.
12 AM 73 and good night from.
I think that clock is set a little fast.
L repeater.
Okay. By me going through the Eastern input, we can continue talking a little bit. That antenna has got a maximum Viswar of 1.06. across that whole band where you used to work. And to get an antenna that low in Viswa and that high in gain, and that cheap and that high in efficiency, with that method of construction, that is a simple stamped piece of sheet metal, And that damn piece of sheet metal is the reflector, the driven element, the director, the impedance matching device, the gamma match, the whole works. Just that one stamping, you add a coax cable to it, and you get everything. That's a lot for your money. For the AQSAY, KQRIW. On that last transmission, your audio is low, the signal became noisy, the propagation is changing, and the combination is I was only getting 50% of your words. I didn't hear the question. If you give it to me one more time, I'll try listening to you on the input. You got it, Doug. About elements that are a tenth of a wavelength wide, 1 inch wide elements at 902 megacycles. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. You're actually hearing me on the input.
That's a big 10-400, buddy. I'll have to say 73 for him. This was TechNet number 1245 of the series. And hopefully more people will be back from Dayton next week. We'll see you guys next week. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. K2LIW and K2KEY. We're clear. Bye-bye for now. Yeah, we're copying you. Beautiful. How are you doing that? You're coming through the western input? Did it get reinstated? Yeah, are you coming through the eastern input? You're obviously coming in. In other words, you're transmitting 147, 375, 975. Is that true, Mel? You're doing it beautifully. Fantastic. Okay. You can officially sign out if you want to. I shouldn't have to have done that for you. Bye-bye. Go ahead, Mel. And tell Julie we appreciate her efforts. She really knows Hubble. Bye-bye for now.
A2RWW2YY. If you got a moment, go over to 448175, and I'm going to turn the station low to you once. You can critique it. You can talk over this stuff, because it's not going to, it only goes one way.
Roger, Dodger. Let's see now. Give me that 448-175. Stand by.
Yeah, I got to disconnect my node from over here and put that over there.
Connected.
One of the New York State residents is an astronaut.
Yeah. 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
Reflector 9126. Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
The time is 1:23 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. 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 Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
WA2 KOP.
N2 UHD Mobile.
WA2 KOP.
N2 UHD Mobile.
And UHD KOP.
Roger, good morning to you. Name here is Nico. I'm on route 9W in New Jersey towards the George Washington Bridge. As usual, every morning.
Good morning, Nico. Name's George. Oh, gosh. Same pothole. This is like, what is that movie? Groundhog Day. There you go.
Yeah, but one would think that after a dozen times you will remember it. I know it happens to me too, getting off the George Washington Bridge. It's one that I always get in. Mind wanders somewhere else and you get into the pothole.
Yeah, well, I'm just, first of all, coming off a real nice weekend, so kind of mellowed out here. And they're resurfacing this road. Well, these are kind of new potholes, actually. It's probably the second time I hit that one in a week or so. Atlantic Avenue is like the road to Burma here. There's another one coming, I'm going west right now. There's another one going east. I found that one out for the first time last week. I think half my wheel got lost in that one. Until I get this road resurfaced. Good for the local shops, I guess.
Yeah, just got on the Palisades, exit 1, going south of the GW. I'm traveling to Hobart from New Jersey every morning. Everyone on the repeater already knows that. I don't know if I met you before. By the way, this is my new rig, Yaesu 7800. I picked up last week and installed on the weekend. I hope it sounds better. Back to you, George.
Well, I can't compare it because it's the first time I've talked with you, so it sounds fine. Sounds great. I bought a new old rig this weekend. We had the yard sale at the Tuna Club in Freeport, and one of the guys was selling a 8500, which is it's like a full radio. Everything's right on the microphone. I keep reaching down for the rig. And fired up yesterday at the station, and very high visor. So kind of a good thing I was checking it out at my station. I found out I have a problem with my antenna there. I don't know what the heck is wrong, but you know, it cuts the power back as it should, so it won't blow anything. So
I don't know if I'm going to be replacing my coaxes or what's going on, but pain in the neck to get to the antenna from the tower. It'll be on a back burner for a while. But,